It's my great pleasure now to introduce to you Conrad Bodman, Head of Exhibitions from the Australian Centre for Moving Image, in discussion with Isaac Julian. It's a real delight for us to present Isaac today, and we'd like to thank him for coming to be with us at such short notice. I mean, I'm sure many of you know Isaac's work. He's a leading artist, internationally renowned artist working across film and visual arts, and he's known for his work that really engages very directly with issues of race and identity. And Conrad and Isaac will be sort of discussing Isaac's work over the next half hour. And then we'll go directly into the Experimental Edge Film Meets Art panel, and Conrad and Isaac will then be joined by Ross Gibson and John Konomos. So over to you, Conrad.
Good. Thanks, Julianne. Well, just to give you a bit of background on Isaac, you probably all know that Isaac's one of the UK's leading artists and filmmakers. In 1991, his film Young Soul Rebels won the Semaine de la Critique Prize for Best Film at Cannes. And he's also developed a very successful career as an international gallery artist with work in collections of the Tate Modern and the Pompidou Centre, to name but a few. He's also recently shown work in Australia at the Australian Centre for the Moving Image and is represented by Rosalind Oxley 9 in Sydney. Last year, Isaac released his latest film, Derek, which explores the life of his friend and fellow filmmaker, artist Derek Jarman, which features Tilda Swinton. And the film Derek won Best Documentary at the Seattle International Film Festival in 2008. So welcome, Isaac. Thank you for coming. Now, we're going to show sort of a number of clips, but there are a few questions that I'd like to ask you first, Isaac. Firstly, picking up on some of the discussions that we've been having this morning with Larry, I wanted to talk to you about the kind of diversity of your practice. You're obviously used to showing your work in a cinema context, also on television, also kind of in a gallery setting. Why have you chosen to work across that range of contexts?
Well, I think that most artists, in a way, kind of make works because they want to make works. And I think in relationship to my own practice, I've been very interested in, I guess, what could be termed an interdisciplinary approach. But I mean, I don't think it's something which is deliberately conceived. That I mean, it really begins really with content and form. And I think the rest follows. And so in my own work and my own interests, I studied as a painter originally at Martin School of Art from 1980 to 1984, and halfway through that decided that film was a much more advanced, revolutionary kind of aesthetic sort of pursuit. And so basically kind of my sort of interest in film and in new art really kind of began this sort of correlation, and I guess really the kind of mutation begins there. Yeah. Before I studied film, I was really interested in also contemporary sort of dance as well. So basically kind of, in a way, all of those sort of early interests kind of coalesced really in a kind of refusal to really be tied to medium. So, I can see that obviously curatorially kind of, institutions have to demarcate practices and artists as well in these different categorical sort of spaces, because that's their kind of remit. But I think the artists, you make works, and as I said, the content and the aesthetic demands are the things which in a way rule, and so,
Sure. So in 1983, you were involved in co-founding the Sankofa Film and Video Collective. Can you tell us a little bit about the significance of that organisation?
Well, we had graduated from art schools, the Martin School of Art, and Gerard Smith's Project Research in London, as it's then called. And basically, we came together really because we felt, at that particular moment, we were able to exploit a kind of declaration which had been developed during Channel 4 And with the ACTT and a number of filmmaker collective and independent filmmakers association called the Work Preparation, and it was very interesting because it was a moment really where through debate really that this integrated practice of being able to be commissioned to make works of, but basically in terms of Channel 4 that those works wouldn't necessarily be. It was the meaning wasn't that they would be shown Channel 4 automatically, but it would be a programme of work that you'd be kind of commissioned to make over a period of time. And in a way, there were a number of different sort of filmmaking sort of collectives and groups, such as Smart Action, and also up north, but also other groups who were working in this sort of way, the Red Street Collective, for example, another sort of collective with Mark Carlin. And basically, there was a sort of conversation really between these different kinds of ways of making film. And in a sense, at the center of them was really the way in which they were aesthetically different. So how you made those works, whether they were kind of a very long gestation period in terms of research, working with certain communities of interest, or there were works which are kind of a political nature, and being worked in a very different way from the kind of more industrial kind of filmmaking sort of method. And so really, and in our sense, there were really so many, there are too many voices which were excluded from the main bastions of British broadcasting at that particular time, and in the film independent sort of scene generally. And so in that sense, we came about with trying to readdress what we saw as this very limited repertoire of images which were being produced, which was sort of in some ways representing black experiences or voices. And at the same time, I think because we generated or had gone to art schools, we were also very familiar with London Video Arts, London Filmmakers Club. And we, in a sense, were in conversation with all these different audiences. And so I think that is also very important. And there's also the kind of theoretical aspect that we held on the board of Screen Magazine, and we were kind of also very interested in trying to challenge or kind of, challenge the kind of paradigm, the theoretical paradigm around film theory. And we were sort of interested in art. We were interested in sort of those sort of conversations, and so in a way our natural audiences were all these audiences. They were kind of art audience, experimental film, art audience, along with sort of black audiences and of course gay audiences, and our works were in conversation with all those consistencies at the same time. I think that was absolutely unique.
So it's a really burgeoning moment for experimental filmmaking in the UK during the 80s. I mean, were there particular artists that you were looking at and particularly inspired by?
There was sort of lots of artists who were working with new artists such as Stuart Marshall. There were also kind of filmmakers like Greg Drummond, of course, actually wanted to make a film about him and his work in life and his struggles, but also there were at the same time, other filmmakers such as Sally Potter, and there were a number of different sort of visual artists which we were sort of in conversation with at that particular moment, like Jez Welch, for example, who ran Video Arts Association, but it had many titles, but the one that I liked was London Video Arts. It was a lot called London Video Access, and of course there dictates the kind of policy sort of changes really, but essentially it was we were in conversation with all of those different consciences.
So in 1991 Young Soul Rebels was released, which is your first feature film. Can you tell us a little bit about how that film came about and why you're particularly passionate about that subject?
During the kind of workshop sort of moment, in the way Young Soul Rebels comes to the end of that particular way of working. But I made a feature film called Looking for Langston, which was a big feature film. It was a sort of film that's one of the smart black and white film and shown in Sydney and various other film festivals around the world. And really it's through that film that we began to sort of argue really that, you know, that there needed to be a feature film that would exist that would have some kind of, you know, black authorship of some kind that would be able to sort of exist and be, as it were, in conversation with all the other sort of films. I mean, I think the Gunshot was made, I think sort of, you know, England produced sort of 10 features or something like that. So it was before the film count, it was before the kind of association with sort of British film and, you know, it's kind of more industrialised kind of development. But, I mean, Young Travelers came about really out of conversations between cultural studies and Stuart Ball's work, Paul Gilroy's work, who are cultural theorists, and really how one might popularise that kind of notion of dealing with these questions, which were essentially questions to do with identity. But it was also about the way we articulate an archive. How do you look at the archive, look at the 70s, it was based in the 70s, and you knew that punk rock and that whole kind of revolution that happened at that moment was, and it had the sort of hegemony in terms of style and British culture, but there was another kind of movement, the kind of soul movement, you know, the looking to the sort of practices of African American music, soul and funk, and really how that sort of how that interpolated the kind of, if you like, young kind of youth at that particular moment in the 70s, you know. So it was really looking at the subcultures, and really it was playing with this kind of whole moment of the archive of Queen's Silver Jubilee, and just really kind of trying to look at that particular moment. I was really interested in the sort of iconography of what people were wearing, the way that these two things intersect, like punk and sort of soul kind of youth cultures, and in a sense it was really about sort of trying to articulate a kind of new sort of Britishness and sort of and how fun that could possibly be, that was, and also how dangerous that was as well. So it was really an attempt to kind of re-articulate a sort of new sort of cinema that was in conversation with other sorts of cinemas which were happening at that particular moment, which was then termed third cinema. There was a big debate at the film festival in 1986, which we had been part of, and we had already connected to a certain internationalism in terms of filmmaking at that time. And so, in a way, Yatra was that sort of British contribution.
Yeah. So I want to go on to talk about some other themes in your work, because a number of your films have really looked at kind of key historical figures, you know, the explorers, writers, poets, etc. And I want to talk to you particularly about Frantz Fanon, who was a psychiatric doctor. We're going to show a clip of this film in a minute, but perhaps you want to tell us a little bit about Frantz Fanon, you know, and your interest in him.
Well, I think, you know, during the mid-90s, I mean, from really the late 80s and mid-90s, we were in what was then known in a kind of particular kind of post-colonial studies kind of milieu, a Fanomania. And in 1995, there was an exhibition at the Institute of Contemporary Arts called Mirage, and Great Design Difference, which was created by Jelaine Tovelos and David A. Bailey. And this was basically a kind of conceptual show which had sort of mainly black artists. It was the first show that Stephen Queen showed his working, for example, and it was the first actual show where I exhibited in a kind of gallery context my work. And basically, I think there was a sort of conversation really between the kind of aftermath of, if you like, debates around post-colonial studies, and the intersection between psychoanalysis and race and the whole question around sexual difference. And I think at that particular moment there was a sort of joining together really of certain sort of, if like, curatorial and theoretical ideas which would become part of the milieu for thinking about international contemporary art, because of course it would be during the making of the Fox Battle film that I would get to meet Ockham Weirzo, who later on became the artist Documentary 11, yeah. And it was actually through the research that we'd done with Fox Battle film where he sort of asked us if we would mind lending us him our research, which we did. We gave him all our files, and that became part of some of his research for an exhibition that he did called Short Century. But basically, kind of in a way, it was like a precursor to what was going to happen. I mean, we didn't particularly know that ourselves, but in the Frantz Fanon film, we were very interested in trying to think about questions which were kind of more sophisticated than the kind of more pedestrian kind of ideas around questions of identity.
Yeah.
And race. I think one of the things obviously that happens historically is that, you know, these debates get flattened out and they get stereotyped as well. But I mean, I think, you know, that we at the moment we're really interested in thinking about Fanon as someone who was an international thinker who had been at the forefront of several revolutions, and his work in Algeria as a psychiatrist working with both the French and the Algerians, and the question of torture that arose during that would be a sort of another precursor in a sense for the kind of war that we are currently in. But at that particular time, when I was doing the film, I was really very interested in psychoanalysis and its sort of interception around the gaze, around the look, around questions of sexual desire, and really how that could be, you know, really theorized in a complex way. You know, so we collaborated with Stuart Hoare and Henry Barber on that work, and it's a drama documentary, it's a film essay which sort of is utilizing the archive, and I was very interested in this notion of the undoing of the archive film as well.
Okay, so we're gonna show a quick segment of this. Just to, for those of you that haven't seen the film.
شو باش تديروا لي هيما هيما شو باش تديروا لي هيما شوفي شو الدم 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 انا مقتل حتى واحد مقتل حتى واحد
Consciousness is not illuminated with ultimate radiances. Nevertheless, in complete composure, I think it would be good if certain things were said. These things I am going to say, not shout. For it is a long time since shouting has gone out of my life. So very long. I was born in 1925 in Martinique. I studied medicine in France and later specialized in psychiatry. When I was 27, I published my first book, Black Skins, White Masks. Why write this book? No one has asked me for it, especially those to whom it is directed. Well, I reply, quite calmly. There are too many idiots in this world. And having said it, I have the burden of proving it.
In the bottom of an abandoned suitcase lay a book bag filled helter-skelter with the icons of an earlier time. Book covers like flags of convenience, launching revolutions, announcing political profits, installing cultural fetishes. Castro, Marx, Mao, Régis Debray, Simone de Beauvoir, Fanon. Fanon stood obscurely apart, notorious for his violence, pure violence. In that moment, considered by some like Hannah Arendt to be the dusk of the Western world, embattled universities, youth revolts, unruly cities.
Okay, sorry, we're sort of fairly short of time, so we can't watch any more of that. It's a very beautiful film. And that was shot on location in Tunisia.
It was shot in Tunisia because it was too dangerous because at that particular moment in Algeria there was a confusion between the feast and the military, and there was the question of a terrorism, basically. Yeah. And so it was something that would become internationalized to a certain degree, but I mean, it was at a particular moment we would have to go army training of a certain kind to film there. Of course, I wasn't prepared to do it. Yeah, but it was shot in Martinique, in Tunisia, and in London, and in New York. So it had that sort of diasporian kind of internationalized kind of aspect, mirroring Fanon's thinking. Yep.
So the theme of migration has been kind of a powerful element of your work across a number of different films, and we're going to sort of take a little look at a clip from your gallery work called Small Boats next. But can you tell me a little bit about the series of works that this film is part of?
Well, I've been working on, I mean, I should just explain that, you know, that I'm someone who, as I said in the beginning, I think that the artists, you know, are not particularly bothered about these questions of category. Mm. And in the sort of early 90s, I started to be very interested in what I saw was happening in a gallery sort of museum context. And I remember going to Venice one year and seeing the works of people like Doug Aitken and Shireen Nassat. And I began to really, I was really very excited about what I saw as this kind of migration of aesthetics, questions which were, at one particular moment, the kind of preoccupation of experimental filmmakers and video artists had migrated, as it were, into a sort of gallery context. In fact, there was a certain radicality that was being proffered, I thought, at that particular moment. It was something to do with spatialization, it was something to do with questions of digitalization, the computer, the way in which one was able to spatialize montage and to think about parallel editing as a way of thinking about sort of moving images. And it's precisely this question about vision, about thinking about really the ways in which sort of, for me, the kind of excitement had, in a way, graduated into this sort of space. And of course, you know, it's a rather odd graduation because, you know, at a particular moment, in a London context at least, the London Filmmakers Co-op, you know, had lost its premises. It relocated in Hoxton Square, where White Cube would relocate. And of course, in a kind of way, you know, that whole kind of emergence then of what would be the kind of young British artist movement. And all those kinds of interests were sort of being, in a way, eclipsed. And I felt at the same time there was a way in which this kind of movement that was taking place, which had some correlation to VR, but not the same relationship, had some connection to cinema, had some connection to sculpture, in a way, it was a little bit like a coming together, really, of my interests. And I detected a certain conservatism in film, and that was very much my experience from making Young Soul Rebels, although it had won prizes and had been shown in various film festivals and had been released theatrically, even in Australia. I was really kind of very dubious about what Promise of Radicality could be in this kind of industrial cinema, in this kind of cinema which was so concerned about nationalism, so concerned about narrative. So in a way, there was this kind of freeing up in this other realm, and in a way, a kind of meeting of different or older sort of questions to do with aesthetics. I think for me, then, it became really interesting to think about this question of a migratory aesthetics, and to really think about, obviously, my own kind of sort of concerns, which have, you know, been concerns I've been working with for quite some time. And in the trilogy, which in a way started with True North, which was shown at the Rosalind Oxley Gallery, or a version of it was shown at the Rosalind Oxley Gallery, and was also shown in New Zealand at the Auckland Triennale. It was a film which was a free screen work, and of course, you know, I don't want to pretend that kind of making free screen works are radical, because of Abel Gantz did them quite a long time ago. But sort of, for me, I was really interested in the question of synchronicity and of montage, and the question of multi-temporalities. And this work, which was also telling the story of an explorer called Matthew Henson, who went to the North Pole with Perry, but had never been credited with of its founding. I was really interested in this kind of secret history. And this was the first of the trilogy. The second work was Phantom Afrique, which was retracing people like Michel Aris's footsteps and looking at West Africa and looking at Christian modernity, architecture, etc. But I was really, when I was working with Christine Van Asch on my Pompidou show, she said, well, you made quite a lot of free screen works. I think it'd be great to do something different. This is where the artist does need the creator to think one's out of one's cul-de-sacs. And for that sort of work, for that presentation, I made a piece of work called Phantom Creole, which is a sort of four-screen piece. And then the last installment of that work is Western Union Small Boats, which is a five-screen piece, which was shown recently at the Grand Jury Biennale, amongst other places. But when that work, in a way, was also the piece of work where I was really trying to look at a different sort of movement, you know, the movement of people coming from Northern Africa to Europe. And I was also very interested in thinking about the legacy of sort of Italian cinema, you know, in this case, The Leopard. And so I was interested in miming Visconti's different locations where he shot that film, and to go back and revisit them, but to reenact something else. And that something else is really in the collaboration that I worked on with Russell Malafant, who's a well-known choreographer, and he worked with me on that work in trying to reconfigure bodies in space in terms of describing these journeys.
Okay, so we're gonna look at a quick segment of this piece there.
Thank you. body going overboard.
At Tauga, we see people, many people stay for the ship there. So we can't take the ship, but the people
take one.
Thousands of immigrants try to make that same crossing every year, trying to land in the tiny Italian island of Lampedusa.
Trovato 11 cadaveri in coperta e 14 persone completamente debilitate.
Sort of powerful, stunning piece, and obviously, you know, illustrates that huge problem that's still ongoing with, you know, migrants coming in from Africa into Sicily and that part of Italy. Now, I want to go on talk about your new film, Derek. We met, I think, probably about 2 years ago at the BFI to have a look at some brushes of the film, and I hadn't actually seen any of the finished work yet, so I'm really excited to see it. Now you were friends with Derek Jarman and kind of knew him personally. Why did you decide to make this film?
I mean, well, the first idea for making the film really was because of Colin McCabe, who is the producer of some of my works and had been the producer of several of Derek's works, continuously nagging me and saying that, you know, there's this interview with Derek, it's 13 hours long, why don't you make a documentary or a film out of this? And I said to him, you've got to be joking, you cannot make a film out of an interview that's 13, if you directed it and shot it, you know. But, I mean, one of the things which was really interesting was really thinking later on, when I was looking at the interview and just really thinking about Derek and thinking about really the kind of work that he had done and really the way in which a certain sort of enterprise around experimental film had become completely dissipated. So in making Derek, I was really interested also in a text that Tilda Swinton had written for the Edinburgh Film Festival on the 10th anniversary of his death, where she gave this inaugural lecture, basically really kind of citing the demise of a certain type of filmmaking that had existed. And so she was also really attacking or critiquing the British film industry as well. And this letter, titled Letter to an Angel, was published in Guardian, and I thought somehow maybe bringing these two kind of texts together, these two archival interventions, one the textual one and then the other one, the interview with Derek. And then slowly we began to start conversations with James Mackay, who was the sort of holder of Derek Super 8 film collection, and basically we began to piece together this kind of mosaic sort of film essay. And at the same time, I began to really think about really the questions which I felt had belittled a lot of the ideas around sort of moving image and its relationship to sort of contemporary art. And I thought that in Derek's work, the fact that he refused to be tied to any single medium, the fact that he painted, the fact that he sort of made installations, it was very attractive. And so really then the film became integral to this curatorial project, which I had spoken to you a little bit about, which ended up being at the Serpentine. And so kind of 2 years later, we have our catalogue in the exhibition, which premiered at the Serpentine Gallery with Derek. And we also were able to secure funding for the work, which was quite difficult, from Channel 4, from Larry's special fund, Art Fund for the 21st Century, from MoMA, which were, you know, really, you know, which we were really pleased to receive, because it was very difficult, sort of trying to make this film, and because Derek fell between two stools, and in a way you can sense the anxiety of like that in the discussions, even I think with Larry, in relationship to the place of moving image work, the continuous kind of way in which the anxiety about demarcating where what is and what is not art, all of that debate. And so it was encapsulated really in Derek's kind of lifelong work. And so in this exhibition I was able to create paintings and also to reinstall an installation piece that he made called Redux, and I reinstalled it as a 10-screen piece utilising his Super 8 film archive, and the show travelled to Kunsthalle Zurich and to Kunsthalle Vienna. But essentially the project became this kind of rather large kind of archival sort of exhibition, and Derek in a way was the centrepiece of that, working with James Akai's Super 8 film archive of Derek Jarman's films and interlacing that with Tilda, who became a producer and collaborator in the project, working on her narration, which she adapted for the film and also performs in the film.
Yep. Right. So let's have a little look at this, and I think we'll wrap up afterwards. Yeah. Isaac's going to talk a little bit about the gallery installation of this piece in the next panel, but this is the film version.
Most of all, I remember you, dear Derek. I remember you saying in an interview you gave in the early 90s, just before you died, in answer to the question of how you would like to be remembered.
I think it would be marvelous to evaporate. I wish I could take all my works with me. That's what I'd like to have, to just disappear completely.
You'd like to take all your works with you and evaporate. It's a funny thing, because the truth is that here, over a decade later, in so many ways you never could. But it has to be faced. In so many others, you have. It's snowed since you were here, and your tracks are covered. Fortunately, you made them on hard ground.
I wasn't very clever. I mean, as a child, I was having real difficulty at school. I saw my reports before I burnt them. They sent me to two convent schools. One, I cannot remember the name of, but the second one was called St. Julianus. It was just outside Oxford, where I was given a real crash course in Catholic brainwashing. These sort of nuns who made sticky lollipops, you know, out of frozen orange juice and whacked you over the hands. I mean, they were real.
Great, that's incredible film. And I curated an exhibition on Derek Jarman kind of probably about 7 or 8 years ago now. You know, he had such a broad range of output. It's unbelievable. Mainly known as a filmmaker, but he was a proficient painter, and his writing work was absolutely stunning as well. And if anybody's ever been to Dungeness, you know, the garden and the house are just fantastic tributes to his life and work. So have we got time for just a couple of questions for Isaac now, or should we... Okay, all right. Okay, well, I just want to thank Isaac, and Isaac's going to be staying for the next panel, which is called Experimental Age. So thanks very much, Isaac.